We're going to open our Rules Committee hearing, and it's really just an informational meeting. So we're going to open our reopen our Rules meeting. Thank you. And this is an informational meeting. We'll open an informational meeting, and we'll start with the ballot initiative. That's the way it was written. I do want to make sure that people understand that time-wise, things are moving very quickly. We have about 45 minutes. If you can compress a little bit, that would be good. We're having these because I think that from all the conversations that have been going on in the interim before, these are two issues that I believe strongly we will be taking up during the rest of the interim to come next session with some ideas. And that will happen if we can start to come to that place where there's a consensus about some ideas that we think that we can build. And that happens when we get a lot of people in the room who have great ideas and start working through that. And I really want to thank the people who came today, because I think we have the right people, at least for the beginning, in the room. So with that, I'm going to invite Paul Warner. And Rocco's not here. Is there someone else from his office? We'll have Paul come on up. Secretary of State's office, who do I see? Thank you. And anybody else? Oh, State Treasurer's office, yes. And the Treasurer's office. And we'll get that started from this perspective, and then we'll bring some other people up. So thank you very much. Yes, we'll let you go. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I think the committee's aware the Legislative Revenue Office staffed the Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring Task Force from last interim that had looked at this issue and had some recommendations. And Lane Shetterly is here to talk about those recommendations. So I'll leave that to Lane to describe where the task force wound up. The one thing I thought I would point out is, as you consider your budget now the state school fund, of course, is a very dominant force in the budget. With your $6 billion allocation to the state school fund for the 09-11 budget, that's about 67%. There's a $9 billion estimate for state and local resources for the school budget. If you go back to 89-91, pre-Measure 5, Measure 50, and take the proportion from the Basic School Support Fund, as it was called in those days, it was 28.7%. If you calculate that out, assume the state still is at that 28.7%, your state school fund for this biennium would be $2.6 billion. Or $3.4 billion less than what it is. So that's been the sea change that's been brought about by Measures 5 and 50 in terms of school finance and in terms of how you manage your general fund budget.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I think what I wanted to just discuss very briefly today, I know there's been a lot of conversation about the financial impact that ballot measures have on the state budget and whether voters have adequate information about the financial impact of a measure before them or not. I wanted to just lay out the process as it is now in statute, so you had that as a foundation as you hear other ideas that you may hear today. As you know, Oregon statute requires a financial estimate committee to meet and prepare an estimate of the financial impact, both in terms of state expenditures, revenues, whether they allocate expenditures or require expenditures, raise revenue, reduce revenue, and impact state and local government. That committee is made up by the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, the Director of the Department of Administrative Services, the Director of the Department of Revenue, and those four members elect a fifth member to a two-year term representing local governments. The committee drafts a estimate of the financial impact. It's required to be fair, impartial, simple, and understandable. That's often a challenge with some measures that come before that committee. And they can either include a specific dollar amount of the impact, or they can provide a range. They're also required to forecast any annual expenditure impacts that may go on. So if it's a one-time impact or it's ongoing, they need to incorporate that as well. The committee may also, at its discretion, write an explanation of the financial impact. and that is limited to up to 500 words. That explanation is printed only in the voter's pamphlet. The actual estimate the committee writes is printed both in the voter's pamphlet along with the ballot title and on the ballot itself. So there are two pieces, and that I think is often a point of confusion because the committees generally do draft two statements, one that is pretty succinct and simple with a number or a range of numbers, and one that provides greater detail. An example would have been in the Measure 66 statements that were just done in the last election. The financial estimate statement on the ballot had simply the amount of revenue raised and a short description of that. The explanation of the financial estimate broke it out into income categories and the types of income that was raised and by how much and the number of taxpayers so that voters would get more information. The statements are adopted by a majority vote. If a member of the committee dissents, that is noted in the statement and provided in the voter's pamphlet and on the ballot to voters so they know if there was not agreement on it. If the committee fails to reach a majority on an appropriate estimate, the job of writing that estimate falls to the Secretary of State alone, and she would write that and then it would get printed. And finally, the committee is required to conduct its business in public. There is a public comment period after a draft of the estimate is created. The committee is required to take into consideration the comments they receive, and they can either amend their estimate or not, and then it is filed with our office. And finally, there is an opportunity for any person to petition the Supreme Court if they feel the procedure of drafting the estimate was not followed or it was the way it was done was in violation of statute. But there is actually no provision to challenge the content or whether or not the committee determined there was a financial estimate. And I guess I should say one last point, similar to rules that the legislature often operates on in terms of when a bill needs to go to Ways and Means, the statute says that if the estimate of financial impact is $100,000 or less, they can simply just say less than $100,000 or no impact and leave it at that. If it's higher than $100,000, then there needs to be a more detailed explanation.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall from the State Treasurer's Office. I oversee the Division of Debt Management for the state. I was asked to speak today briefly about the impact of initiatives on the state's credit rating, and I will also, hopefully if it's all right, make a brief remark about the local government credit ratings, which are also impacted by the initiative process. I've worked for the state since late 2004. And whenever we go out to sell bonds, we have to disclose any potential initiatives or things that could change the budget. And I counted them up this morning, and there have been 8 initiatives that we've had to disclose that could have major repercussions to the state's long-term financial health since I've worked here. And I think that is a telling statistic. Regardless of the price tag committee and all the information that's given to voters, it's the instability that the continual citizens initiative filings and then the votes tend to have when investors and rating agencies look at the state credit. It's not saying whether they're good or bad, it's the instability and the uncertainty. I asked several investment bankers on a local level in Oregon what they thought, and they said it's the same thing. The initiatives in and of themselves don't change your credit rating. But on the margins, let's say you're going to get a better credit rating, it's something that is held against us a bit. Moody's has a scorecard of 50 states. They look at a lot of different aspects of different states. And we have been improving consistently over the last few years our financial management. We've gone from the fifth tier to the second tier. We've gone from the third tier to the second tier for our economy, believe it or not. But our governance has stayed right in the middle. We get excellent marks for all of our financial management practices, rainy day funds, good management control levels at DAS. I think we do a pretty good job on the debt side, but we have this initiative. So all of our good financial management is offset by one of the proclivity, I think is the word they've used, for initiatives. And it could be as simple as capping revenues, capping expenditures, or mandating revenues or expenditures into certain categories. Anything that takes away the flexibility of the legislative body to govern is seen as a credit negative. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. I was asked to briefly address the effects of initiatives on the state budget. We looked quickly, and since 1981, there's probably about 11 initiatives that have affected the budget. I just want to point out four. Paul's already mentioned the biggest effect, Measure 5, and as he said, before Measure 5, K-12, the state school fund budget was about 25%, 28% of the state budget. After Measure 5, it's been about 40 to 45% of the total state budget. And as that budget increases, you know, less and less revenue is available for other things now that the state school fund is up to $6 billion. Measure 11 in 1994 set mandatory sentences for certain felonies, and the effect was to increase the number of beds that were needed in the correction system. In this biennium, the cost of that measure is estimated to be about $355 million, but roughly 30% of the corrections budget. By the end of this biennium, the bed need because of the measure is about 4,700 beds. And each of the recently constructed new prisons hold about 2,000 beds. So you can see that that measure created a need for at least two additional prisons. Measure 66 was passed in 1998, the original Measure 66, not the most recent one. And this dedicated 15% of lottery proceeds to parks and to watershed improvement. In the 09-11 biennium, that's about $160 million that is basically not able to be directed elsewhere by the legislature. There's very limited legislative authority over how that money is directed. The original financial impact estimate was for about $46 million per year to be dedicated, so it's about double that now. And then Measure 99 in 2000 created the Home Care Commission. The Department of Human Services has estimated that the collective bargaining costs for that for the initial group of home care workers that were eligible for collective bargaining because of that measure is about $65 million in the state budget. About $26 million of that is general fund. The original financial impact estimate was for roughly about $1 million per year. So I think with respect to the state's budget, the common theme is that initiatives generally require a new expenditure, but they don't require that a revenue source to pay for them or is ever identified.
Questions, Representative Garrett?
Ken, is there a figure for how much of the general fund is consumed by direct voter mandated expenditures?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, no. We would have to do a little work, but we could look into the other initiatives and come up with an estimate for you.
Thank you. Other questions of this panel? Thank you all. It's informative, and I think we have to get our hands around that those issues. And it's easier to understand how hard it is to make estimates when we see these numbers. With that, we'll have Lane Shetterly, Andy Miller. I think, Lane, do you have a computer? Yeah. Very good. Andy Miller, Leslie Johnson. I think there's only two more from them, and that's we'll wait for the others afterwards. Thank you. And Lane, if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lane Shetterly, attorney in Dallas, and I'm pleased to be here at your invitation today to address the committee on the perspective of the Task Force on Revenue Restructuring that I chaired during 2008. I think that was the basis of the invitation anyway. You've heard the statement of the problem. I think it was well articulated by the panel that preceded us, and really we found the same things in our work of the task force. We identified in our work really two major risks to budget stability and revenue stability, one being the volatility of the income tax as our principal general fund revenue source and the problems associated with that. We came out with a recommendation on kicker reform and a constitutionally established rainy day fund to address that. The other issue that we found that was the threat to budget stability was the initiative process, as we've heard today. So ours came at it from a different direction, but found the same thing. Representative Garrett, your question to Ken Rocco just at the end of that last panel. We don't have quite the information you were looking for, but if you look at the graph on the back of the handout here, what we did determine, and these numbers came from through the Legislative Revenue Office, that 50% of new spending since 1990 has been driven by the initiatives that have passed. So that doesn't tell you the total general fund, but it does give a perspective that since 1990, 50% of new spending has been in response to voter-approved initiatives. Mm-hmm. One of the recommendations that we made with regard to that ballot initiative, and we looked at several suggestions at how to address that from a budget and revenue stability standpoint, and the recommendation, the principal recommendation that we made was to require that ballot titles for initiatives that are either going to have a significant fiscal or a significant revenue impact, an unbudgeted revenue or fiscal impact, be required, number one, to announce that in the ballot title, as much like you have now a men's constitution, something on the order of has a significant fiscal impact or has significant revenue impact. So that's actually there in the ballot title, with the intent then that that would call the voters' attention to the fiscal impact statement that appears also with the measure. Some way to try to make that relevant to the vote that they're asked to cast. And the thinking here being not to make it easier or more difficult to pass an initiative, but to call to voters' attention that initiatives either cost money in terms of adding new programs or they remove revenue to sustain current programs, and that information should be called out up front to voters, just as in the legislative process we have a Ways and Means Committee that is tasked to figure out how to fund all of the great ideas that that we pass in the legislature from session to session. This implicates the same kind of thinking there. Our recommendation here, which is outlined in the handout that I gave you, could be implemented statutorily. We did not want to recommend a constitutional amendment addressing the initiative process. Max Williams and I got our fingers singed badly with that in 1989, I think it was, on a signature requirement for constitutional amendments. This could be done statutorily, and we think we thought as a task force would have done a good job of at least raising to voters' consciousness the fiscal and revenue impacts of ballot measures that they're being asked to pass.
Thank you. We'll hear from each person, then we'll come back.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Miller, Oregon Business Association. You should have received some written testimony from me electronically, so I'll skip the intro and get down to the question I was asked to address, which was what work has been done in the past by groups like ours and others to address these questions. In the fall of 2008, OBA and the governor's office assembled a diverse group of organizations and individuals who were interested in studying the initiative process. The coalition was broad and included representatives from the governor's office, public employees, the City Club of Portland, AOI, the League of Women Voters, and many others. We had bicameral, bipartisan legislative sponsors, Senator Frank Morse and Representative Larry Galizio. The City Club of Portland had done extensive research on the initiative process. The coalition relied heavily on the recommendations of the City Club to launch our discussions. We separated proposed changes into two groups, statutory and constitutional. The statutory concepts included changes to the ballot title and signature gathering processes. Although the changes that were made in these two areas were modest, most in the group felt that the voters would welcome these changes. In fact, pre-session polling indicated that while few Oregonians believed Oregon's initiative system should be left as it was, most supported changes at the margins. The scope of the 2009 bills reflects the sentiment. Others in the group, including our legislative sponsors, sought more aggressive constitutional changes. The primary objective was to implement an indirect initiative system that would directly involve the legislature in the initiative process for a number of reasons, not the least of which is it would require referral because it was constitutional. These ideas failed to gain traction. We are pleased to know that efforts to restore integrity to the initiative process are again a subject of discussion within the legislature. We especially welcome efforts to avoid unfunded mandates created by the initiative process. In the last session, and you addressed this, Lane, our method for addressing this issue was to include the fiscal impact in the ballot title, thus giving voters a more clear picture of what their vote would actually do. Polling showed that making an impact statement could further confuse the voters, so we were reluctant to pursue this avenue of change. We look forward to working with the legislature and other interested parties as we sort out the mechanisms within the initiative system that allow the unsettling practice of budgeting by ballot. We are not sure yet what this looks like, but eager to be part of the conversation. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thanks.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Leslie Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the City Club of Portland. The City Club published a long-term a report that was a product of a long-term study on the initiative referendum and referral process in 2008. And the impact of the process on the state's budgeting system and its financial condition was one of the major topics of our report. We came to a conclusion relatively easily that was fairly significant, and given the amount of effort we put into the language of the conclusion, I'm going to go ahead and read that into the record. Mandating changes in revenue and expenditures through the initiative system disrupts the state's budgeting process, confounds the legislature's constitutional requirement to balance the state's budget, and negatively affects state and local bond ratings. Furthermore, a degree of inherent unreliability and lack of context for financial impact statements limits voters' ability to make informed choices about ballot measures with significant fiscal impacts. I know there's been some tweaking about fiscal impact statements and ballot titles since the report came out that we've been excited to see, but our recommendations and our appetite on the committee level for more significant reform remains, and so the City Club has an advocacy committee on this subject, of which I'm presently the chair. At the time, we interviewed the state treasurer. We got data from Moody's and from Standard & Poor's on the negative effect on the state's bond rating. And it was a little more specific, as I recall, than what the representative of the treasurer's office just reported to you. For example, the kicker, we understood, does play a significant issue in the rating and the bonding agency's view of our fiscal condition, because it affects our ability, the state's ability to plan long term and to be in a position to respond readily when there are dramatic changes in financial and economic conditions like we've experienced in the last couple of years. I think one way to kind of not be quite as redundant as I might otherwise be of some of the other reports is to point out that the report identified a number of states that have some kind of subject matter limitation already in place that protects them from some of what happens in Oregon. I think in every case, those states enacted these subject matter limitations at the time that they enacted their initiative laws, whether they're statutory or constitutional provisions, but Alaska does not allow voters to use the initiative process to do anything with revenues and appropriations. The expression is that the management of the assets of the states belongs to the legislature. Illinois limits initiatives to amendments to their Constitution, Article 4 on the structure of government. Maine requires that any measure providing an expenditure of funds in excess of appropriation becomes inoperative a certain time after the legislature convenes, unless the legislature funds the initiative. Missouri does not allow appropriations of money by initiative. Montana does not allow appropriations. Wyoming provides that you cannot dedicate revenues by initiative or make or repeal appropriations. As I indicated, these limitations were all put in place at the time that these states enacted the initiative process. And I would like to just propose that even though Oregon was not actually the first to adopt the initiative, even though there's a widespread belief that we were, we might be the first to fix our initiative system. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would also like to offer, we have tried to get copies of the report around to every member of the legislature over time. If there is anybody that doesn't presently have one at this point, they could contact the club or let me know and I could make sure that
Yeah, we would love that. I think we would like to make sure that we each have one.
Maybe Cheyenne, you could send me a copy of the committee members.
Okay. Questions for this panel? Thank you for being here, and thanks for the work you've already done. I think it is the stuff we need to build upon, because I think we've looked at it, and what I'm committing to is that in this interim rules, at least in as we move forward, is going to continue to work on this issue, because I think it is important.
Mr. Yes. Chair, if I may, then just on that point, just another resource. It's mentioned toward the bottom of the text of the testimony I handed out, but in 2002-2003, it was my privilege to be on an NCSL initiative and referendum task force that looked at the initiative and referendum nationally with what states are doing, what reform efforts have yielded. I would commend that to committee staff as a good resource to see the national picture. Been 6 or 7 or 8 years, but I don't think in this arena that things have changed that much since then, so I think it'd be a valuable resource. It's an NCSL product on the website.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And the last two would be Cappy Eaton and Norman Williams. Oh, you come on up too. Oh, Margie, I'm sorry. I saw you with, I forgot to look across. And this is the last panel. Yeah. This is the last panel on this topic, and so keep it as narrow as quick as you can, because we do want to have a conversation about our other issue. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League was pleased to participate in the initiative reform group that worked last year, and we are of the belief that there are other suggestions that could significantly improve the system other than the improvements that were made in the 2007 and 2009 legislative sessions. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Cappy Eaton, who is going to get a little more detail.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I simply am going to underline some of the suggestions that have already been made. We have 6 specific recommendations for the 2011 session that we hope you will take these concepts and work with them. First of all, upfront indication of costs for any proposal requiring general fund expenditures should be on any initiative. Second, application of a balanced budget rule to ballot initiatives, whereby revenue sources would be identified for proposed general fund expenditures. Third, a timeline to indicate how long before twice defeated initiatives may again be placed on the ballot, such as a 1 election cycle. 4, a restriction on proposals requiring general fund expenditures. 5, a restriction on types of proposals that amend the Oregon Constitution. And those two were also recommended in the Portland City Club's recommendations, that we look at what other states have done in limiting what can be proposed by an initiative. And lastly, use of the indirect initiative process, which would require legislative review and public discussion of initiative proposals. That is also a concept which our members are very strongly in support of doing, and we would hope that the legislature would look at the idea of indirect.
Thank you.
The indirect initiative. We continue to believe, have a strong belief on the right of citizens to initiate initiatives, but we feel that what has been brought forward already with House Bill 2082 in 2007 and the revisions that were made in 2009, that these are necessary steps to take forward so that Oregonians have a right to initiative process that's good and good for the quality of life in Oregon. Thank you.
And Cappy, you forgot to mention who you were. You did mention who you represented, but you didn't say Cappy. Okay.
For the record, my name is Cappy Eaton.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. For the record, my name is Norman Williams. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University, where I also serve as the director of our Center for Law and Government. I've already provided the committee with, by electronic means, a written copy of my statement. I won't belabor the point by reading it or discussing it. There are two salient points in it, though, that I want to bring to your attention right now. First, Oregon's system of initiative is very permissive and very much like the California system. Oregon has very low thresholds for the number of signatures required to put a measure on the ballot, either as a constitutional amendment or as a statutory measure. Oregon, unlike California, has no time limit for collecting all of the signatures. And Oregon, unlike California, has no limitations on the subject matter that initiatives may have, and thereby inviting initiatives regarding expenditure measures. The second point I want to have is that California provides very much a cautionary tale as to what may be Oregon's future if no reforms are made. There are three types of initiatives that exist in California. One, which you've already heard about a little bit today, are the so-called earmarking initiatives, in which the initiative mandates a certain level of spending. Secondly, there are revenue restricting initiatives, which cap taxes or tax increases. And third, there are structural initiatives, which impose procedural obstacles that make it more difficult for the legislature to balance the budget, such as supermajority voting requirements. In California, their experience with all three has been very unsatisfactory. Measure 98, Proposition 98 in California, which is very much like Proposition 5 here in Oregon, mandates a certain level of education spending. In California, for this fiscal year, Proposition 98 spending will be $44 billion out of a state budget of approximately $110 billion. So over 40% of their budget has been, by that proposition alone, directed by the voters. On the revenue side, Proposition 13 has severely capped local and, to a lesser extent, the state government's ability to raise revenue. And even more importantly, Proposition 13 requires a supermajority two-thirds vote for the state legislature to enact any tax increases and a two-thirds vote to pass the state budget. The consequence of that this year is that the California legislature this month is facing a $20 billion fiscal deficit that they must close when the legislature itself controls approximately one half of the general fund, because voters have taken away the other half of the general fund from control. That, members of the committee, I fear may be our future if we don't do anything. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all. So we're going to close our informational hearing on the initiative reform, and I appreciate all the people who came. And we're going to open an informational hearing on campaign finance reform. And with that, I'm going to call Senator Metzger, John DeLorenzo, and Janice Thompson. And if I can, I'll have Senator Metzger first, and then Janice Thompson. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chairman Roland, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and your Vice Chair, Senator Berger, talked to me yesterday about coming forward, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify before you. Maybe the last time I testified before a committee in the legislature, so, you know, this is kind of cool. I did feel like this was Groundhog Day when I walked in, and all over again when I saw former Representative Shetterly up here talking about initiative reform. The first day I walked through the legislature,
where you came in.
Time flies when you're having fun. I was going to speak very briefly and narrowly about a piece of legislation I introduced in the Senate side in the short session. Wouldn't be able to move through, but it's an issue I think it's important, and it is very capable of moving through. It just needs that time to do that. And some of your other witnesses may talk about the general issues in terms of campaign finance reform. Like initiative reform, it's been around forever. But unlike initiative reform, campaign finance reform under the Oregon Constitution, as we've tested a number of times, is very, very limited. So that's why bills very seldom get any further from legislative council, except with that little letter attached. This is a nice idea, but it's clearly unconstitutional. So in order to be able to really try to advance campaign finance reform, I do believe that the legislature looks at those areas in which can have an impact on campaign finance reform and which we have an opportunity to put into law. The bill that we introduced for discussion in the Senate that I hope you'll take up next year is one that provided an opportunity as a result of the recent Oregon Supreme Court decision in Vannetta versus the Oregon Government Ethics Commission regarding the ban on gifts that we passed the previous legislature. It was a very interesting decision, saying that you can offer but you can't receive. I'm used to that in my personal life all the time, but I never really heard that before. But what was significant, if you look at the decision, and I'm happy to share with the committee the opinion of our legislative counsel on this. It was significant in the fact Mr. DiLorenzo was the attorney for the plaintiffs on that, so he has some real expertise on that. But it was very fascinating in that the court withdrew a comment they made in Vannetta 1 in which a number of parts of campaign finance reform have been hinged upon, which is that the legislature may not limit, as speech, the giving to a legislator. And they withdrew the comment that said, regardless of how that may be used. And that was significant, and that's how the gift ban was upheld, even though Mr. DiLorenzo won the case, it was unconstitutional. They found a way that you could not accept it, and therefore it would still allow the legislation to go forward. But what was significant in campaign finance reform is by withdrawing that comment, and legislative council said, you can possibly, as a statutory measure, do some limited campaign finance in terms of what a candidate, for example, may be able to use a donation for, because the thing that was hinged upon that in Vannetta 1 has been withdrawn. So specifically, what the measure that I introduced would ask for your consideration next year, based on the fact that it may actually be able to go into effect, would be to limit the pass-throughs from one candidate to the other. It would not limit, you know, the payment of anybody to anybody they want to give to, or a caucus or a political committee or a cause or a candidate. But once it got into a candidate's PAC, the idea was it was to support that candidate and their service as a state legislator or whatever, and that was the intention of the donor, and therefore you cannot pass it on to another candidate or someone else. And the opinion of legislative council is nothing is guaranteed. But based on the withdrawal of Vannetta, that might be a piece of campaign finance reform that, yeah, you can give it to them, but it's for your use, and therefore whatever use that is deemed valuable by that candidate may not necessarily be subject to non-restriction. What I thought was important about that, and I think if you're really serious about campaign finance reform, and Janice was there before the committee and testified, is that because it's not de facto unconstitutional now, and if the Attorney General would say, yeah, this possibly could be defended, it would go into law, unlike others which are just set aside. And then it would have to be tested, and then the court would be able to give you, the members of the Assembly, a little clearer picture on just what kind of limitations, if any, that you may be able to make on campaign finance reform. And the fact of the matter is, unless you provide something for the court to have to make a decision on, they're not going to tell you what that is. And so you have to put something out there, and I think if you do something narrowly that has a chance of being constitutional, then you put the court in a position where they're are likely going to have to weigh in and give you guidance for the future. So that's the bigger topic. Again, you never know what a court's going to do. And Mr. DiLorenzo has the case here. It's interesting. The U.S. District Court, just this week ruled the revolving door statute in Ohio, very similar to ours, as unconstitutional under federal law. So you just never know what you're going to do until you do it. But I don't think that this body, and this is the one thing I'll leave you with, should ever be afraid to move something forward that you think is good policy that has a basis and a chance of being constitutional, because that's what the legislature is supposed to do. The judiciary will weigh in, as the judiciary's role is, if it is challenged. But if you let them off the hook and never give them something to challenge, then we're not doing our job in the legislative branch of producing policy. So I'll leave it with that. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about this next year, and again, maybe my last time of testifying, so I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee.
Representative Barrett?
Yeah, not a question. I'd just like to comment to thank Senator Messer for coming in. He and I have discussed this idea, and I have been on board with this for quite a while. I see this as a way of assuring that candidates come in here more on their own volition and their ability to
get the community behind them, and the pass-throughs have always bothered me a lot between candidate committees. So I appreciate Senator Metzger, and I appreciate him coming in, and I'm just honored to be sitting here and thinking that this might be your last committee. But you know what? Did you see Representative Shetterly's been back and back and back and back? So I just want to point that out.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
So, Ms. Thompson, next.
Janice Thompson with Common Cause Oregon. The last time I was before this committee on this topic was in April 2009, related to House Bill 3009. And in less than a year, we're in a significantly different legal environment due to both federal court case and the Vanetta 2 case that Senator Metzger referred to. Regarding Citizens United First, it's important to realize that it actually has very little impact in Oregon. I've heard lots of people say, Citizens United kind of just cleaned away, swiped away everything at the federal level, and that's not the case. I have a handout to illustrate this. Using House Bill 3009 from last year, because only one section, the ban on Treasury dollars for independent expenditures, would need to be deleted. Section 5 on the second flip side of the... So in other words, there's a lot that could still be done because Citizens United, the very significant, was still, didn't affect all elements of the regulatory regime at the federal level. Now, that said, obviously not being able to include this particular provision has major, policy implications for, whether you want to start going down that road of direct regulations, regulations on direct contributions to candidates, particularly since, people are doing all kinds of second guessing about where the U.S. Supreme Court may go next. So it's interesting to see at the federal level the legal signals kind of heading away from regulation, and as Senator Metzger mentioned, reading the tea leaves in Vanetta 2, some indication that the Oregon Supreme Court may welcome revisiting Vanetta 1. 2 points on that topic. One question I've had that you would be in a position to ask legislative counsel to check out is whether or not current litigation that's in play by the proponents of Measure 47 could be expanded such that Measure 47 could be the test case that Senator Metzger is referring to. If yes, that would be troubling to me. I couldn't support Measure 47 because it had many, many, federal legal red flags, long before we saw the Citizens United case. And all those red flags are even more significant post-Citizens United. So that might be something to check out. I think in general we need to keep in mind that 47 is still on the books. The next topic then is what is then a good test case? And I would suggest that a package approach more like House Bill 3009 is better as a test case than just the pass-through ban suggested by Senator Metzger. Again, this might be something to get feedback from legislative counsel on. If they were going to design a good test case, what would they do? Three comments then on the standalone pass-through bans, which pretty much mirror what I said before the Senate Rules Committee. One is that they do address a very real concern from a policy perspective. I think they could be done on a standalone basis without as many problematic side effects as might occur when you do take other regulatory steps in the campaign finance arena, where sometimes you don't want to do this unless you also do this. I think relatively speaking, pass-through limits or bans definitely would affect the flow of money, but wouldn't have necessarily some of the problematic side effects. Also, the role of pass-throughs in legislative fundraising has definitely increased since 1992. We have some data indicating that. So I think it's fair to say that there's a problem that really exists. With the resulting kind of concerns about transparency and concerns about increased clout of leadership PACs and individual elected officials who are linked with those pass-through contributions.
I'm going to have to ask you to kind of wrap up a little bit now so we can have a couple other people
to talk. Right. The two other points are, I think there are federal legal problems. Representative Brewer and I talked about this. I turned to my legal resource, which is the Brennan Center for Justice. They pointed me to a Ninth Circuit court case where stand-alone pass-through restrictions were not upheld. Where they have been upheld at the federal level is where there are a component of a comprehensive package of contribution limits and they're needed to prevent the circumvention of limits, which is why they're in like House Bill 3009. Finally, back to the test case, if the test case involves repealing Measure 47, which is, I did it in House Bill 3009, but I think politically, to avoid political criticism, if 47 is repealed, it should be replaced with a more comprehensive approach than just pass-throughs. So I think there's a political ramification I wanted to identify.
Thank you. Mr. DeLorenzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John DeLorenzo. I'm a partner at Davis Wright Tremaine. I was counsel on the Vannata 2 case. I was also counsel on the Vannata 1 case that declared Oregon's regulation of campaign contributions unconstitutional. I'm here to comment on Citizens United and the practical impact that it may have on legislation, but I couldn't help but think when my good friend Senator Metzger mentioned that it is the role of the legislature to pass enactments and the role of others to challenge them, what a marvelous symbiotic relationship this creates. But as you know, in late January, the United States Supreme Court came down with a decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. It's probably one of the most significant decisions from the 2009 term. It held that the ban in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act 2002 on corporations making independent expenditures within 30 days of primaries or 60 days of general elections was unconstitutional. This was so even though corporations could work through their own PACs. It is of equal application to unions. The court overruled this decision in the Austin case that had earlier determined that vast aggregations of wealth could be controlled within the political process. It also overruled its decision in McConnell with respect to portions of the McCain-Feingold law. It recognized the rule in First National Bank Boston versus Bilotti that corporations have First Amendment rights, which is also extended to unions. The First Amendment prevents Congress or legislatures from punishing those who engage in political speech, which is indispensable to democracy. And that principle, the court said, was no less true if speech comes from a corporation. The court noted that a prior case, Davis versus Federal Election Commission, had taken the position that wealthy individuals could not be prohibited from expending whatever they wanted in independent expenditures, and that no distinction could really be made between wealthy individuals and corporations. Under the First Amendment, it's a different analysis than under Oregon's Article 1, Section 8, but under the First Amendment, if a law is directed towards speech, it will fall unless the government has a compelling governmental interest and unless the law is narrowly tailored to address that interest. Up until Citizens United, there were two governmentally recognized interests. One was preventing corruption or the appearance of it, and then the other was the distorting impact of vast aggregations of wealth that expressed views for which there was little or no correlation to public support. The practical impact of Citizens United is that there is now only one recognized governmental interest, and that is preventing corruption or the appearance of it, and that is it. So were the Oregon Constitution ever amended to allow campaign finance regulations like Mr. Meek tried to do several years ago, the only statutes that could pass, that could be held muster would be those that were directed at corruption or the appearance of it and that were narrowly tailored. So what's the practical impact of all this? Well, the practical impact is I think it changes the tenor of the whole debate. From a public policy perspective, I see no reason why the legislature should pass laws that limit the amount of money that can be contributed to a candidate, thereby limiting the candidate's overall funds for broadcasting his message or her message, when corporations or unions can spend unlimited amounts to talk about what that candidate stands for. Why in the world would office holders want to unilaterally disarm to not be able to protect themselves against attacks? And from a citizen's perspective, I personally would rather hear from the candidate what the candidate stands for than from some union or corporation as to what that candidate stands for. So in my view, from a practical perspective, it has pretty much ended the debate. What we should be concentrating on in the arena of campaign finance should be disclosure. And there are all kinds of things that we can do in the disclosure arena. And I would suggest and will support legislation next session to bring greater clarity and transparency to our political system. I can comment if you have any questions also on Van Atta 1 or Van Atta 2, if you'd like.
We're going to have to get back to voting. But I appreciate that, and we will get back to you. There are two other people, and if you could, we'll call them up real quick, but I'm really going to ask you to write stuff to us and get it to us later. Because I don't really think that we have time, and the rest of the committee, if you need, you're excused, and I will sit here and take a little bit of testimony. You're welcome to stay for a few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I'll accept your invitation.
Okay. And then I'll close the committee. But I appreciate it. And we are going to take more of this. We will be inviting these people. We will be inviting these people back to speak to us when we have our meetings in March. So with that, you want to say a few words? You certainly can.
And Mr. Basler.
And Mr. Basler.
Marion Haynes, Oregon Business Association, for the record. I'll be really brief. The chair of our board of directors was involved in a working group with the Secretary of State on this issue. That work group is no longer meeting, but she did ask us to continue to work on this and try to come up with proposals, which we will plan to do. We've brought together a coalition and are continuing to expand that and work on that. From our perspective, there's a lot of, not everything that we agree with that was said already. We have three principles that we've adopted that we're going to be using to do our work on this. One is disclosure, I think, is an easy no-brainer. We are willing to look at limits on expenditures, not bans. Those limits, we believe, need to not be so low as to drive independent expenditures. Now that that is an open case, if they're too low, it'll force money out of that, and you won't be able to control your own messages. And finally, and most importantly, is that it must create an even playing field among all the different interest groups and players out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Basler, I work for the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees. We're a union representing about 23,000 public and private employees. Just a couple of principles. Make sure, I think, narrowing in on what your actual goals are. If the goal is to get money out of politics, I think that's really hard and may not be something you want to do, even. Breaking through all the advertising that's out there for candidates, they're not competing against each other, they're competing against shoe commercials and diet soda. You've got to think about that. Also, having a really solid understanding of how money is raised. I could explain to you how we do it, but it would take 3 days, and I need a flow chart and a whiteboard. It gets kind of complicated. And finally, the bigger the working group, I think, the better. Every union collects dues, political funds very, very differently. I don't even understand how most of the other ones work. And I bet that's the same for nonprofits, business associations, and everyone. And having a broad understanding of how money actually flows into the political process, it would be the best way to regulate it. Thank you.
Any further discussions? Thank you both. And I want to thank everybody that came. We will be having further discussion? So I want to close the informational hearing on campaign finance reform, and I think we're done. We're going to adjourn the rules meeting for today. Thank you.